You're listening to We Are Recovery Radio. I'm Russell Brand. I'm your host. Today on my show, and it is my show, though perhaps it belongs to all of us. I mean, what is property but theft, according to Karl Marx? But let's not get into him at a time like this. We're going to be talking to three people in recovery, only one of whom I know before. Recovery is, in these terms, defined as a life without drugs and alcohol, although you can be in recovery from many things and many behaviours. I myself am in recovery from basically all pleasure. Anything that could possibly be nice, I'm in recovery. Recovery from one day at a time. Let's introduce our guest today, because we're going to be having a discussion about addiction and, more importantly, about recovery, a life away from addiction. First up, opposite me, is Mary. Mary, can you tell me how long you've been clean and a little bit about yourself and your addiction and your recovery?
Okay, so I'm Mary, and I would describe myself as a person in long-term recovery, which to me means I've been continuously abstinent from alcohol and other drugs for over 26 years.
Oh, well done. That must be knackering. You must be parched.
Yeah, and I'm quite old now.
Oh, yes. Is it getting easier or harder?
It gets different. Mm. It gets different. And I mean, I actually cleaned up 35 years ago the first time in 1981. And my journey then was I was an intravenous drug user.
Top of the tree in the drug world, intravenous, just so you know the hierarchies. If you are an intravenous drug user, that's very much a king of the jungle there. You're using proper intravenous drugs. You've not recoiled at the foil. Don't back off when you're on the silver page. Keep right on till you're putting things directly into your bloodstream with somebody else's works.
Yeah, it did me no favours. But anyway, one of the things that it does do when you use...
Was it any good? Was anything good?
The first time I used heroin was like a spiritual awakening.
Nice cuddle, nice brown cuddle.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. The best feeling I'd ever had in my life until that moment.
Don't do drugs, kids. So next up is Vicky. Vicky, well, tell me a little bit about your recovery.
So today is actually 7 years total abstinence.
No! Yes! Today, this very day, you've been 7 years clean from what?
Everything. Heroin, alcohol, pot, coke, pills, Red Bull, whatever.
Even Red Bull?
Yeah.
You've added that on the list. It gives you wings.
It really did. I had to stop drinking that too.
Bloody wings. Yeah. And how have you found that? Like, tell me a little bit about, like, what, with your drinking and drug use, why did you stop? What was so bad about it?
I used heroin. I injected heroin.
Well done.
I got clean from that because I overdosed at home in my bedroom.
Ooh.
Didn't go down too well.
What happened? Where did you, at home with who? Family or?
Yeah, my parents. So I'd been clean, I'd kind of got off the everyday vibe of taking heroin. So I'd gone out and just got a little piece off one of my friends, come home with it, and my tolerance level had dropped, so I just overdosed.
Oh, bloody hell. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What was it like then?
It was like my dad was picking me up, because I'd been telling my dad what we used to do if we overdosed before, like, you know, walk you around.
Well, you've given him, like, right, Dad, in case I overdose...
No, I just told him what had happened, like, the time before, you know, like, I think it was about a week before I overdosed, I was telling him about it.
Well, do you see that as some sort of moment of grace?
I'm very grateful for it. You know, now I know I've done, like, different training and things, it's like, that's not the thing that you do, but at the time... It works, so you're not meant to do that.
Oh, aren't you?
No, you're meant to walk around, you're meant to just ring the ambulance, but we'll...
Just ring the ambulance, that's a good thing to know, a little bit of take-home knowledge. If you do find somebody that's overdosed, not that I'm imagining that it's, you know, that's our listenership, people that are looking for people to overdose, but what should you do?
From what I can remember, it was ring the ambulance, get a paramedic to help them, because as soon as you start moving them, the drugs can move around the body more, so it circulates more and that spreads the poison.
How do you know that now?
Do you know what? I don't even know.
What do you do for a living now?
So I work at a homeless centre and I support other homeless alcoholics and addicts.
That's a good journey that you've been on. We'll be talking about that a little bit more later. Sarah, we've never even met before, but I know that you, like me, are a person in abstinence-based recovery, a 12-step recovery, which by my understanding and the way that I work it is one day at a time I make a decision not to drink or use drugs, and in my case, not to look at pornography, not to allow my sexual behaviour to govern me. Tell us, as Mary and Vicky have done, a little bit about your experience of addiction and recovery.
My experience of addiction, first of all, is like I started from a young age. Like I was, you know, I was always sort of hanging around with the wrong crowds, getting into trouble. And then when I found sort of, I was just so bored at home all the time.
Why?
I don't know. I just like, I've come from like a loving family and that, but I was always just wanting to like look, see like the dark side. I always wanted to be outside. I was never quite right. You know, I could never sort of sit with myself or nothing. Always wanted to just be out, get in trouble, just be around like other people that are like me, and just got up to mischief. And then when I found, and all, you know, all that sort of wanting to be liked as well. So I would sort of...
Hold on a minute, what's that about? Like, you know, now look, obviously I'm a person that's in recovery, yeah. So I've got a fair understanding of what you're saying. But your emotional state, a feeling of wanting to be liked, being bored at home, you're saying all these are the contributory factors that made you become addicted to what substances?
Well, no.
Stuff.
Well, what's happened is when I did like first take a substance. So first of all, it was like cannabis, and I tried crack when I was 15.
That's
and
a bit
alcohol.
Young.
Yeah, I know. But when I did, it sort of shut my mind up, and I actually just felt, I felt more just calm, you know, and I enjoyed the effect that it produced for me at that time.
So it's like you, in a way, you were using it to sort of medicate yourself and make yourself feel a little bit better because your previous mental condition was unbearable.
Yeah, and I felt like I couldn't really communicate with people. And when I'd have like a substance in me, I could sort of feel like I could talk. I felt more confident in myself. And that was quite short-lived because it just really did progress, you know, and... So in the end, it's like I've gone from sort of being around lots of people to sort of pushing everybody away from me. You know, I'd manipulated everybody. You know, my family would cry to me, please, Sarah, get help. What's wrong with you?
This
you
is what, because what, at what point is this? How long have you been, how have you?
Oh, this went on for like about 20 years. In the end, I was on everything.
You're covering a 20-year period. At what point was it clear that it was problematic?
When I'm in a room, I'm on my own, I'm crying my eyes out, I can't stop, I don't know why I can't stop, and I'm just doing anything I can to possibly get some substance in my body.
Well, how long have you been doing it? A week, a fortnight, 2 years?
Years.
So, like, for a couple of years it was all right then?
Yeah, at first it was like I could sort of just maybe do it now and then, like once at the weekends, but then it just progressed and it was like every day I wasn't even eating. It was just constantly, I wake up and I need that. If I can't get nothing, I just want to sleep. I didn't want to live at the end.
So I suppose what all of you have described to a degree is sort of the conditions that precede drug misuse in all of our cases is sort of, well, for me, I think I felt, when I was a little kid, I felt very alienated and lonely and a bit worthless. By that, I mean, like, sort of, if I was left on my own too much, ultimately my thoughts would turn a bit sort of dark, and I didn't feel like I fitted in with other kids that well, and I didn't sort of really feel that much at ease with my family, and I had a real strong sort of compulsion to escape. So like, I was older, I suppose I was about 15, 16 when I first like had a puff or whatever, but like I think immediately everything that I was doing, I think even before drugs actually, the way that I was eating food I think was a little bit weird. I think that the sort of like the way I was relating to Penguin chocolate biscuits was a little bit off key. I think when I was a teenager, the way I was looking at porn was a little bit obsessive. I think the relationships that I had even with like my parents had an element of obsession in it. I think that the condition of addiction is attaching to all sorts of stuff before you find substances, before you find something that will really works for you. I mean, I don't want, it's not like it's an endorsement of drugs. I'm just saying that sort of drugs does the job more efficiently and acutely than bloody, you know, wagon wheels. What do you reckon, Mary?
I think you're absolutely right. I think my first thing was fantasy.
What do you mean?
Not living in the reality that was around me, but creating this world in my head that I preferred to live in than what was actually going on around me. And my heroine was Anne Boleyn, so that was not, it wasn't a good choice.
You liked Anne Boleyn, did you? Emery, yeah. One of the Emery the Eighth's wife. Why did you like her for?
Because the course of history changed because of Anne Boleyn.
It's a weird thing to be into. Oh, I like that. Course of history's changed. Anne Boleyn, brilliant. She got a fucking head cut off, didn't she?
Yeah,
did she?
But a bloke, she forced a man to give up his allegiance. She changed the whole history.
Yeah, it cost her head. I mean, it's like, my head may be in a bucket, but I've certainly, those monasteries have been dissolved for good. Take that, Catholicism.
Well, you could see, so I didn't make a good choice. Yeah,
I think that anecdote does reveal, Mary.
Yeah.
That you attach to odd heroes.
Yes, very, very odd heroes. Yeah, very, very.
She may be mother of Queen Elizabeth I, but she had her nut lopped off.
She did. She absolutely did.
So, what, also, did you imagine that you were her or something?
Yeah.
Just thought about it.
Yeah. Just kind of wanted to be that kind of romantic figure. I romanticised her. Also,
You're not in touch with reality.
No. Reality, as soon as reality got too real, I wanted to change it.
I still feel that a little bit. And I don't bang on about it, but I've not, I'm 14 years clean and sober. Vicky, 7 years. How long, Sarah?
I was 3.5 years, but I'm like nearly 100 days now.
Well done.
Well done.
It's very hard, isn't it? If you have a relapse, it's very difficult to get back, isn't it? But the thing that I've noticed is that the feelings, they are pretty much, well, I still have them. I'm just learning to deal with them in a very different way. Mary, tell us a little bit about your early experiences. Like you're saying, as a kid, you're a mad fantasist. You're obsessing all day long about Anne Boleyn and the Tudors. How does this turn into, if I don't get an armful of the brown, I won't be able to make it through the next episode of History Today?
It's quite a strange journey, isn't it? As a kid, I stole and lied from almost the moment I could open my mouth. I just did it, and I knew I did it. And I would sort of try and pretend I didn't. And then when I was about 13, I lived in a little village in Hertfordshire, and I went to a boarding school in Malvern. My life and played sport.
Should be all right. Should be like Enid Blyton, if you're going to believe the class model.
Yeah, absolutely should have been like that. But when I was about 13, we were on holiday, and
where was you?
We were in Cornwall.
Nice.
With my mum and dad, and I had some older friends around, older cousins. They were drinking. I went out. I went to my first disco. I tried alcohol for the first time and got absolutely bladdered.
Mm.
And I wanted to change. I wanted to be older. I wanted to be able to join in. I wanted to get involved. And from the first time, and it was the same with every drug that I ever took, I never had any control over anything. And with alcohol, I got absolutely bladdered. I was sick all over the place. And I knew I had a problem with alcohol by the time I was about 15.
About 15, you already thought, this isn't for me, this, but...
But I want to be stoned and I want to change the way I feel. So I started to try other things. I tried puff first. And puff used to make me paranoid and not able to speak. So I like speaking. So
clearly.
That one, thank you. So I jogged that one on. But I have to say, with any of the drugs that I ever took, even if I didn't like them, if there was nothing else around, I took them.
I really identify with that. Like, because a lot of drugs I was taking too much, they made me nervous. Like cocaine, for example. I've never liked it. I don't think I've ever had a very nice time with cocaine. Every time I've taken it, I feel like, oh God, I'm like, all sort of lonely, trying to make the best of it. And often for me, I'd score for a few mates. I'd crush up theirs with Rennie indigestion tablets so that I could have more. And then like sort of watch them as they went, ow, my nose! But my stomach feels lovely. I would just sort of feel nervous and awful. Yeah. This obsessive behaviour that Mary was describing, and a willingness to use any substance, no matter what, to change the way that she felt. Does that make any... do you identify with that,
No,
Vicky?
For sure. I think I got my first drunk at 15, and it just escalated from there. From 15 to 19, I went from drinking to smoking pot to doing crack to doing coke. I was a smackhead by the time I was 19. Yeah.
Right, so you really got out of control quite quickly. So what were the accompanying social conditions of that, which is a nice way of saying, how quickly did you end up... So didn't you wind up living on a bus or something stupid?
Yeah.
So tell us how that happens.
Just randomly,
But it's not random, because people aren't just selected on a quiz show to live on a bus, Vicky. They make choices, bad choices, then ding, ding, you're living on a bus. Now, how did that happen?
We found, myself and my partner found a bus parked up in the middle of some woods, so we went to nick the diesel out of it, and some geezer came along and told us how to start it up and take it away with us. So
who's this kindly woodland elf?
So
hello there, you were going to steal the bus, were you? Just the diesel, though. No. Why, if you put this wire with this wire, hey presto, it's a fun bus and a new house. Is that really what happened in your actual life?
Basically, he had dumped it in the middle of these woods, so we went along to nick the
woods.
Diesel. Black Park.
Whereabouts did you live, mate, if you don't mind me saying?
Slough.
He's living around Slough, already you're in trouble. Before you know it, you're in some woods and there's a bus in it, and you and your fella at the time, why was you up for nicking diesel out of a bus? What were you trying to...
We were nicking petrol and diesel to sell it, to make money, to buy gear.
Gap in the market.
Yeah.
No worse than what America's doing in the Middle East, really. It's just on a smaller scale. So, like, okay. And then, so you went there, you went to the woods, you nick a bus, and then what happened?
We drove it back to... We actually parked it up outside the homeless centre that I work at now. Yeah, it was like the bane of their lives.
That's outside Shock. Was it Slough Homeless?
Our Concern, yeah.
Slough Homeless, comma, Our Concern, yeah. Or Shock. They've really worked to make that anagram work there, haven't they? So you pulled up your bus there, luckily with diesel in it, because you'd left that in.
Yeah.
And then you and your fella just pitched up there for a while.
Yeah, we stripped it out, put a sofa, a wardrobe. We even had a dressing table, like one drawer had our pins in it.
It's not cribs. Don't boast about your bus.
You have to do what you can, didn't you? I made it homely. We had carpet in there, everything, so far.
Right. Yeah, go on. But what was that? So, like, even though you're living on a bus with your fella, what was actually that period of time like? You're 19, are you, by now, in this story?
About 21 by
then. About 21. You've been an addict a wee while. It's gotten a little bit out of control. You're living in a bus.
So I'd come out of prison to sleeping in a car park stairwell.
What's the bit where you're in prison? What were you in prison for?
Being carried in a stolen car, taken without consent, just minor stuff.
Just minor stuff, and accumulatively it led to prison sentences. Yeah. So this is like this early addiction that where you're describing, like, you know, an identification with what Mary said and what I have said and what Sarah said, feeling like a kid a little bit alienated and basically like Blue Peter isn't entertaining enough. Before you know it, you're in and out of stir and living on a bus. I mean, how do you think this transition happens? I suppose because the drugs that you were addicted to are illegal and you just had to have them anyway.
You know, someone come to live with me. I was smoking pot. He was doing heroin, and I was curious.
It was just like, in a way, that was normal life for you, and that's just the way that it went. When did it get to a point where it became untenable, unlivable? Like, if, like, you withstood the prison, it was obviously things were going wrong for you if you end up in prison and, like, you know, you've overdosed and your dad's had to walk you around, we now know ill-advisedly, and you've still tolerated, like, the bit where you're living on a public transport. When's the bit where you think, I've got to knock this on the head?
I mean, like most addicts, I got clean, I give up using heroin after I overdosed at home, and then I started drinking because obviously drink was okay. You know, parents done it. Everybody has a drink. But that soon went off the rails again. And
right. You thought, like, so even though you recognised you couldn't take heroin because it's making you overdose, you thought you'd be able to drink safely for the same reasons that you took heroin. Is that why you went to drink? Because you couldn't stand being on your own or whatever?
Being me, basically, yeah.
What do you mean by that? What's wrong with being you?
Nothing, I don't think, now. Because I've had to learn how to be me, how to be myself, how to live a, you know, life like everybody else does. But at the time, I didn't want to be in my head. I didn't want my thoughts. I didn't want to live my life. And the only way I knew to get around that was to just get off my nut.
Yeah.
You know, to take whatever anybody's got and use it.
That's the only idea that we had. I think that's one thing that we sort of all seem to have in common, is that we find it unbearable to be in our head, thinking our thoughts, living our lives, being ourselves. Something seems objectionable about who we are. So anything that can change that feeling is worth doing, even if the consequences of it seem quite dire. Now, you've got 7 years today. Well done. That's brilliant. Did you say 27 years?
26.
26. Well, congratulations. That's Thank incredible. You. Now, I've got 14. Now, you had 3.5, Sarah, you said.
Yeah.
Now, what is it like, having presumably got to the point where you knew you had to get clean, where you couldn't drink or use again, you then got to the point where you thought, actually, I am going to drink and use again. What happened?
What happened is I stopped to it. Like, you was talking about the obsessive behaviours, okay? My head can be like, you know, it can separate me from people. It can...
How do you mean obsessed, separate you from people?
Like, it's like mad in the minds, you know. Oh, you don't, you know, like, it will separate me. No one likes you.
Well, what's it, is you it doing don't that fit now? In. Does it do it now? Like, say you're now doing this podcast. Do you think, oh, I'm not as good as the other people in this podcast? or on this radio show. Did it do it now?
I had fear, but I know that I have got a story to tell.
What do you do then? How do you sort of like, if you're feeling in the moment like I'm not good enough, or as you said, separate from other people, what is it that you do to make yourself not feel separate from other people?
I pray.
You pray?
Yeah, I just...
And what do you mean by pray, if don't mind me asking?
Just to like a higher power, my own higher power, just to like to remove my fear.
So it's like you have a word with yourself, is it?
Yeah.
Like you sort of go, right, there's part
remove
of me. Go on.
Yeah, just to remove my fear.
You ask this higher power to remove your fear. Now, a lot of people might think that sounds a little bit superstitious or maybe even mental, isn't it? Like, you know, that you're sort of like inside your own head going, remove my fear. I mean, I suppose there was time not that long ago where most people would have had some sort of spiritual type practice, but these days, and when dealing with something that's regarded as, well, firstly, criminal, drug addiction, secondly, medical, thirdly, perhaps psychiatric, fourth, we're now coming in from the outside, spiritual. You're saying that you need there needs to be a spiritual aspect.
Yeah, meditation. I do meditation every day. It centres me with the day, like when I come out, because my mind can just think too much sometimes.
So what it's like, you feel like you have to have a different kind of... This is what I recognise and identify with. When you say that thing of not feeling good enough and feeling separate from people, I get that all of the time. And like, do you too? Do you get that also? Yeah. That's normal, isn't it? It's not just me and Sarah. Don't to make a podcast where people listening go, oh dear, Sarah and Russell seem a bit unusual. I like those other two. Actually, I'm not keen on Bus Lady either. Mary. No, there was the Anne Boleyn thing. No, they're all weird. I'm going to listen to something else. It's not good enough. So, like, but I got that. I get that feeling all the time of feeling separate from people and also like you. Part of the main things I do are, one is I try to have a connection to an aspect of myself that is higher, by which I mean is not just my memories about myself, not my fears about the future, and not my drives on a sort of basic primal level. I try to commune with that. And then I try to talk to, the other thing I do is I talk to other people with addiction issues that some have got, more time than me, some that have got less time than me. Those are the things that I do. And I suppose what that does is it starts to undermine the sense that I'm on my own and that I'm not good enough, because I hear other people say sort of really similar things to me. So it makes me feel like, oh, right, that's normal then.
Yeah.
So that you're doing that now, are you?
Yeah. I mean, I always felt like alone all my life. No matter who I was around, my family, anybody, I always felt I just didn't feel like a part of. And then I remember my first time, you know, I went into a 12-step fellowship and I heard people sharing and I thought, bloody hell, like, you're all like me, you sound like me. It's like a mirror image of myself. And, for once I felt like I fitted in.
So that makes you feel better, just even the idea of fitting in. Mary, you've been doing this longer than any of us. So why do you, do you still recognise the things that we're talking about? Do you still have those feelings of alienation and being apart from and separateness and fear and all that?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I would say that the last year has been one of the hardest.
Why?
My dad died.
Oh, bloody hell, I'm sorry to hear that. What did you do? How did you cope?
I just had to really... up all the things that I've done for the last 26 years, which I stay really close to my friends, just doing the next right thing, one foot in front of the other, a day at a time, because there were times during the last year when I didn't really want to kind of go on. But
oh, right. The loss of your father, it made you feel suicidal almost.
Not really. It knocked me off my feet. I loved my dad and we'd reconciled. I nearly destroyed him. I got arrested for prostitution and things while I was using, and he hated it. He absolutely hated it. And it took us 23 years to really, really put it right. But the last 3 years of his life, we were really good and he was quite ill and we become friends, and then he died, and it blew me away. And I'm not married, and I don't have kids, and so I felt very alone with it, and left alone with that stuff, that madness that comes up. So I've just, and
what madness?
Oh, I don't know that.
Not the Anne Boleyn stuff. No, it didn't come back, did it?
The Anne Boleyn stuff didn't come back. No. Sadly, happily, no. Just that thing that, you know, I'm alone. I'm the only one. There's no one else has been through this. You know, it doesn't go. You know, that's why I still...
So what
hang
did you
around
do then?
With joyous, happy people like yourselves.
So that's your solution to, like, because grief is obviously not something that's exclusive to those of us that identify as addicts or alcoholics. That's human. Mm. And so when something tragic, sad, like the loss of a parent happens and it's destabilizing, what methods do you use to... Was there any point before I think I'm going to use?
No. No, I know, I've known that that's not kind of the solution. I did, actually, that's not strictly. I did want a doctor to prescribe me some more pills. Pills, were, you know, I thought, well, that would be just
what
to take the edge
they?
Off my life. I didn't even get that far because I went to see the doctor and he
just
said...
Just pills, you just fancied general
pills. I just fancied something to take the edge off life.
Got any pills? Well, what's wrong with that? Just everything, just some pills, anything?
I was devastated because he said to me, Mary... You're fantastic. You're doing really well. So I was like, oh no, gutted. But you just keep.
Have this athlete's foot powder. There you go. No one goes home empty handed.
So, but anyway, bless him. But it changes. You know, that's the thing. It's the difference. The difference between being abstinent in recovery and using, for me, the biggest change is using, it was the same. And I knew it was the, you know, you knew.
That's why we do it a bit, isn't it? Like, I mean, at least.
Familiar.
Like, yeah, this is a familiar thing. Like, sometimes life, all these unruly things are happening. It's frightening. It's scary. You're losing people that you love. You don't know what's going to happen in the world. I remember thinking in down times, at least with drugs, you can buy them. Like, you know, it is a sort of something that is transactional. Whereas human beings, very unreliable, may turn up, may not turn up, may love you, may not love you. Anything can happen. That was like, you know, when I feel frightened and doubtful, that's how I see it. Now, these techniques that Mary's describing of dealing with a human, like an ordinary but very sad human event such as grief, how do you cope? Like, you're a mother, aren't you now? Vicky, you've got a job. You're, like, trying to live, like, a normal and helpful life. You've mentioned that you work at a homeless facility in Slough. And I imagine basically everyone that's using that's a drug addict, aren't they? Or an alcoholic?
About 90%, yeah.
Yeah. And, like, so you're living a useful life. What do you do when things kick in for you?
You know, my instant reaction is just, I want to get off my face now. Yeah, because that's my only way of coping with things. It's the only way that I knew for so long. You know, so it, like, these past 7 years have been like being a child again. I've had to learn how to grow myself, like, mentally and physically, because it's just, you know, I don't know how to deal with life. The only tools I get is what I learn off other people who are also in recovery. You know, I have to go out there and speak to people who are more sober than me, or, you know, if it's an issue with my child, then, you know, I'll go to a mother and say, what the fuck do I do? You know,
you start to ask people for help, have you?
Yeah. And it's a strange thing for me because, you know, I don't like asking people.
Why?
For stuff. I like to be independent. I like to deal with shit on my own.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to rely on somebody
else. Like the glory
else.
Days back on the old bus.
Yeah. No.
No, I'm the same way, you know. It's like you sort of think that I would... It's something... do you not really trust people?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't trust
massive
people.
Massive trust issues. Massive.
Why is this?
Don't know.
Don't trust
them. I don't
them.
Know if it's me, if it's them.
What do you think's going to happen? That people might hurt you?
Yeah.
I think they might. Not you.
Thanks,
yeah, they might, Vicky. Watch out for them. No, I mean me. Like, my feelings around sort of like I try to sort of hold back a little. It takes me a little while before I feel like I can be in a trusting relationship with someone. I suppose maybe that's something I've learned from being around other people that are addicts and are working a 12-step program, is like different ways of relating to other human beings. Because I think sometimes I have a bit of a tendency to expect too much of other people, to expect them to take care of me and look after my problems. Now, Sarah, you've got 100 days, which is very, very commendable and very, very impressive. But you must feel that after, like, having clocked up 3.5 years and then relapsed, that there is a fragility to your recovery. How are you finding, what is your life like at the moment? Do you have a job? Have you got family? What are you doing? What's your life like?
I'm in the office at the moment. I'm doing some voluntary as well.
What for? What sort of thing?
for like a treatment centre, just helping out there. I was doing
Bournemouth, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm doing that.
In a treatment centre, what, where you went?
No.
What's that like, being around a treatment centre and doing voluntary work? Is it helping you?
Yeah, because what, before I'd sort of just like made these rational decisions and like I said, right, I'm going to leave the voluntary. And I just ended up just staying at home.
Well, you made decisions that basically ended up isolating you a little
bit,
did
where
you?
I'd wake up in the morning, it's like, I've got nothing to do. What are you doing? Just want to go back to sleep. It was loads of things, what happened.
Yeah, I see. Hey, Mary, you've got more time than any of us. What do you think when you hear Sarah talking about that and these decisions to isolate? Have you got anything that you can pass on to us and specifically to Sarah in this situation?
Well, yeah, no, because I relapsed too. I had 5 years and then went out again. And and sort of when I got back, I just knew I didn't want to go. I knew I just didn't want to use again. And it was just that thing of, and, you know, 26 years down the line, nothing has really changed. That sort of absolute basic stuff of just, as you've said, you know, just trying to make that decision every day to stay clean. To engage with other people. I think the most important thing for me is to knock that isolation on the head and to stay connected, and to, you know, to turn up to the groups that I enjoy going to, that, you know, those, and have regular ones of those, and have a couple of people that I engage with more, and, you know, to work on myself, to keep working on myself. And
when you have a commitment to structure like that, it's like you're taking yourself out of the equation, isn't it? You're going, right, no matter what I think,
this is what I'm
doing
to
it.
Yeah.
It might be a bit 5 minutes before where I go, I don't feel like doing that anymore, I don't need to do that, I'm all right now. But that's irrelevant, because I've already made the decision to turn my life and will over to this process. Yeah. So I am going to that thing. Mm. Now, that's quite a regular thing for me. So that now I sort of end up attending groups quite often, because, like, I've took myself out of the...
Me,
you know,
too.
Cause I'm,
yeah,
gnaws
me too.
It up if I use my own head. Why are you laughing for, Vicky?
I'm just agreeing with you sometimes.
What, the laughter of agreement?
Yep.
All right. What, you don't feel like going things?
Sometimes.
What do you mean?
It's very rare that I actually get any time to myself. You know, doing a full-time job, being a mother, having a partner, I'm here, there, everywhere. And on that very odd occasion where I get like even 1 hour where I could just hide away from the whole entire world is, to me, like magical. Because it doesn't happen very often. You know, I get 1 hour maybe a week and I enjoy it because I need that time for myself as well as other people.
You like that, do you? What do you do if you have some time on your own?
To be honest, you know, I've always been a kind of loner. I like just sitting in my own world. I like reading, you know, just anything. As long as I get to sit in myself for even half an hour, 20 minutes, you know, sometimes... like every other day or something. I just like to have that small amount of time where I can just have a bit of peace and in my head.
I've heard that it's important for us people in recovery to spend at least 20 minutes, half hour every day where you're not engaged with the outside world, where you're not thinking about what other people think of you, how much money you owe, what's owed to you, who might fancy you, who doesn't, what's gone wrong. That you spend like half hour just like in the presence of something higher, in like, I suppose, you know, like whether it's sort of inner peace, universal spirit, God, call it what you will, where you're not just thinking about, oh, bloody hell, I've ripped my tights. That's my own example.
That was you last week.
That's right, it was a terrible time, actually. I had no business in that bramble bush, but damn it, the berries are only ripe for a week. I'll take it where I can find it. So, yeah, that's an important aspect of what we do, isn't it? Like having that sort of like a little bit of time connecting to something higher.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right, so there's a few things that we've touched on over the course of this conversation. We've talked about sort of the importance of fellowship and connection to other people with the same condition as us. We've talked about the importance of spending some time having a connection to a different aspect of ourselves. What other things can you think of, Mary, that are necessary for a life outside of it? Because it's really easy, isn't it? If you've lived like a life where you've been a drug addict for like a long time, that becomes a powerful component and a governing, I don't know, aspect of the way you identify. Now, you mentioned just in passing that you did sex work presumably to sustain your addiction. Tell us more about that, because I think that's the kind of thing that's like murky and shadowy and people don't talk about it openly. And I reckon that by mentioning it, you've sort of signalled that it's okay for us to discuss it. So will you tell us about it, please?
Yeah, it was... I was a very, very, very unsuccessful sex worker. I would not call myself an expert at it by any stretch of the imagination.
But I mean, who among us can? Who among us can say that I am a prince prostitute or something?
But in the end, it was something I just thought, okay, I can do this, which is something that most women can do.
Can make some money.
In a way that I ended up...
It's quite common, isn't it, with women addiction? Is this something you have experience of?
Yes, I have done.
I've picked up just... I'm a man, and I don't suppose it's as common for men, I'm guessing. I don't sort of know that many straight men that have been involved in sex work inside, with my experience with alcoholics or addicts. And I suppose the reason that it's interesting is because, one, it feels like a very extreme thing. It seems like a sort of a line to cross. I suppose with men, perhaps there's crime and violence. Mm. You feel like, oh, right, I've gone there, stealing from people you care about. And I suppose there is a sense that sex work is that it's a transgression against the self. That's my assumption as a man who doesn't know about it. Is that... fair, Sarah, as a woman who knows more about it than I do.
Yeah.
It's also something I found in recovery, something I found very easy to sort of say, I did that because I was doing drugs. It's not something I would choose to do today.
Right. So there's a lot of shame attached to it, is there?
Yeah, no, not now. Not now. There was at the time, but not now, because I just sort of think, that was what I had to do. You know, it was better than going around and clumping someone over the head for money.
So I suppose that I can't personally identify it with sex work, I do identify with shame very strongly. Mm. I understand that shame was a big component of my addiction, the feelings of shame and how shame kind of perpetuates. It's odd that addiction leads to a behaviour where shame is so prevalent and preeminent, and I suppose it's highlights the importance of self-esteem, doesn't it? And having a life that is esteemable post-active addiction. Like once we are clean one day at a time, once we make a decision to become abstinent from drugs and alcohol, have you found that it's a necessary part of that, Vicky, is to do things that make you feel like you are worthwhile and valuable? And what are those things, if it is true?
I think... Even today, I still have self-esteem issues.
Do you? Why?
Yeah, they're really low. And I've always battled it. When I was using, it was because of an ex-partner. And when I was drinking, it was because of a current partner and because of the drink. And I didn't believe in myself. And still to this day, I sit and I still question myself on a daily basis. I do all this good. I work with the homeless and I try and help people who are suffering from addiction and alcoholism. And, the only thing I can give to them is my experience. And I'm like, well, using the fact that you're a junkie alcoholic is not really a very good, experience to put onto somebody else. Why would they want that? Why would they want to learn about what you got up to? And that's my head. My head tells me that you're not good enough because you're just a junkie.
But it's vital, isn't it, really? Because, the thing that I've learned from people that get into dire situations as a result of addiction is that it's really hard for them to be contacted by people if they think that they don't understand what they're going through. I think it's like the number one lament of people that are really, really suffering is, you don't know what it's like. You don't know how I feel. You don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I'm going through. So in the end, actually, the very things about which you feel most shame, the very things that are the biggest challenge to your self-esteem, become sort of, I don't know if it's a word, alchemized, transitioned, mm-hmm. transformed into something valuable and something important. That's true, is it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it that's why sort of getting clean and belonging to a recovery community is really useful, because the thing that defines most people coming in, speaking for myself, I hated myself, I was on the floor, I felt absolutely useless. And suddenly, without just being me, is useful. And I have something to offer other people and I can help other people. And to be of use has just been so important to me. I've got to feel that there is a purpose to life.
Go on, yes. What do you do? How have you of use, if you don't mind? It's not a challenge. I'm not saying you're not. I'm saying, how are you of use? And what do you do now to be of use to others?
Well, I am within the recovery community. Yeah. I'm a pretty sort of stand-up member of it. I'm very connected to it. I attend the groups regularly. Mm. I mentor several women, always have done. If anybody asks for my help and I can, then I will.
Do you make this a sort of a priority
it's
in your life?
When I cleaned up again this time, I just said to myself, this is the most important thing I do in my life is this. Everything else comes second to this. And that's the truth of the matter is that, you know, when someone, if you're an addict and you clean up, the world is not going to give you a life. But if you're prepared to put in some effort on yourself and let other people help you, you really can turn your life around and have a great life and have a laugh, you know, have fun. You know, I'm a fanatical football fan. I hosted a football show in the 90s. You know, I've been to European Cup finals. You know, I'm reconciled with my family. I teach yoga. I have a wonderful
life. Oh, wow. So, like, your life from this rather desperate and unpleasant sounding thing, revolting some bits were, has transformed into something where you feel like you're of use to other people that are suffering and you live a life whilst you continue to prioritise recovery, your relationship to, like, I suppose, abusive behaviours around misuse, drug misuse. Your life is no longer absolutely defined by it because you do loads of things there. You said, like, you host a football podcast and teach yoga. You're doing all sorts of things that are built upon the platform of your recovery. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's brilliant. And it's never too late. It's never too late. You know, within the community that, you know, I'm a member of, that we're all a member of, you know, anyone can come. It's almost impossible to be thrown out. You know,
anybody listening to this now that feels like they have issues with addiction, and that's actually who we're most interested in talking to, people suffering from addiction issues. And the next show, in fact, after this one, is a call-in show for people that think they might be suffering from addiction issues or worried about someone else that might be suffering from addiction issues, to call in and speak to Mark Dempster, who's a Wears resident counsellor and advisor, and what you can glean from him isn't worth knowing. So, like, he'll be coming up next. People that are listening to that now, like if you're having strong feelings of identification, it's important, I suppose, to know that there is a solution and there is a different way of living, no matter where you are on the addiction scale, whether it's like, you know, maybe you're living on a bus, for example, listening to this on a stolen wireless, or, like, you know, wherever you are, there is a sort of a possible way back. Now, you've done one of the things that's sort of very brave in recovery, Sarah. You've got back after a relapse. What, like, say there are people listening to this now in a comparable condition to that you've described. What would you say to them, people that have perhaps even relapsed recently that are struggling to get back into abstinence-based recovery? Because what people say about abstinence-based recovery is it's too bloody hard. That's what people say. It's too hard. Let people drink a little bit. Let people take a little bit of drugs. Like, and people resist it, don't they? What do you got to say for it, Sarah?
To reach out, really. Just reach out, no matter what your head is telling you. You know, just reach out to people, like, who's doing the 12-step program and who can help you, or local services, you know, and get connected again. And, you know, people will have open their arms to you. You know, we're all here to help each other.
That's a lovely sort of idea, isn't it? Do you feel that you are part of a community now, that you're not on your own?
Yes, I do.
So what, every day do you speak to other people that have got addiction issues that are staying clean the same way as you?
Yeah, I call people every morning. I'd call, like, a few people who's either out, like, still in active addiction, or who've just sort of come back into the rooms, or it's their first time, because I think that that is really important.
Well, you help other people, do you?
Yeah.
Even though it's sort of like, so some people might think some people think 100 days is unbelievable and amazing and inconceivable. Like, I remember when I had a day or couldn't get clean, the idea of 100 days was something like an unthinkable monolith. But, like, but for other people, they think 100 days, well, and you're already, your concern is helping other people that have got less time. Is that important to you?
Yeah, it is important to
Why?
Me. Because when you was speaking about esteemable things, that is a massive thing for me to do, you know, and that's something.
How is it helpful?
Because, you know, one addict helping another, you know, I was helped. If it wasn't for another addict, I wouldn't have known nothing about, like, what's wrong with me or anything. I wouldn't have known nothing, you know, and they've helped me.
So you're starting to sort of broadcast on the frequency of compassion, as opposed to when you were earlier on talking about your addiction. It's very sort of, I don't mean this in a judgmental way, I don't think, like, it's very selfish. Like, you're on your own in a room, talking about all of us, thinking about yourself, negative and down and stuff. And then now that we're in recovery, we're forced to think about other people and helping them. And it makes you feel a bit better, innit?
Yes,
you think, like,
does.
Sometimes when I'm, like, about to like sometimes, you know, when you're in your own head and you think, I'll just say some horrible things to myself in my own head, pass the time, it's nearly bedtime, run through a few horrible things to go, well, you were shit at PE, what were you thinking then? You're not good enough in bed. What's wrong with you? You're a wreck, right? Sometimes, like then another voice, it's a little thin, reedy voice, but Russell, you gave that gentleman a sleeping bag. And I'll go, yes, that's right. I did give a gentleman a sleeping bag. Be quiet, other me. Be quiet. Now, am I describing there, Sarah, mental illness or a fine life in healthy recovery? You've paused, Sarah. People are going to think that you meant mental illness, but didn't say it. That's what people will assume. They'll assume that was what you reckoned.
Both.
It's a bit of both, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, right, both. So we're still sort of crazy. Like, one of the things I like that people in recovery say is that we're all mental, but not at the same time. You know, so that, like, when there's moments, like now, when, like, I'm... You know, as I keep saying, got 14 years. So, but like, sort of when I like have something like where I'm scared about a financial thing or a relationship thing or anything, actually, I talk to people with more time than me and go, oh, I'm feeling this, this thing's happened, I don't know what to do, I'm going to fall apart, this is mental, isn't it? And they'll go, no, that's just a normal thing that happens in life. You're overreacting, as you always do, and part of you is trying to look for an excuse to take drugs or do something erratic. Think about it, sit still, be quiet, calm yourself down. Don't do all those voices, you sound like a nutter. You know, and then what I try to continually do is talk to people with less time than me, like you said, Sarah, because then, yeah, I think that I'm engaging with people in a way that's not typical. Whenever I'm doing something that's sourced from my recovery, i.e. helping others, turning up at some rehab, doing some act of kindness, while I'm on my way there cursing the very fact that I'm having to do it, I think I wouldn't normally be doing this. So that means I'm not living my normal life no more. And listeners, I'm holding an imaginary steering wheel now as I'm driving there grimacing, thinking, right, if I'm doing something that I wouldn't normally do, then I'm not the person that I used to be. I'm becoming a different person. Mm. And actually, when people like, you know, like men with less time than me that I mentor, like when I talk to them and they're all grateful to me and they go, thanks, Russ, you've really helped me there. I think, yes. Well, I'm terrific, aren't I? My God, what a great guy. And then I also think, like, the stuff that I'm saying to them when they're talking about their relationships, I'm going, well, she's an independent person. She's not just, don't just exist to look after you and your feelings. So I think, that's how you run your own relationship. Better stop doing that. You know, like, it sort of, you hear yourself saying stuff that's sensible, don't you? And think, yes. Oh, I'd best do that. Do you have that, Sarah?
Yeah.
Like, from this, we're all at different points in our journey, aren't we? We're all sort of still basically dealing with the idea of feeling a bit balmy and a bit sort of inadequate and worthless. We've all used that kind of language, but all of us have found a different way of living. And what seems to be integral to us is staying connected to one another, staying connected to a higher aspect of the self and helping other people. That's just three things that we can endorse as ways to change your life if you are suffering from addiction issues. Would you agree with that, Mary?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the three most fundamental important things. Yep.
Oh, my God.
Well done. You nailed it.
Just came up with that. That's just off the top of my head.
You nailed it, yeah.
Do you think so, Vicky?
Yeah, anyone will think you thought that before.
Shut up. No. You're being sarcastic. You belong on that bus. Straight out after it, I'm going to find the disused route master. I'm going to kick it and take the diesel. I'm going to park it in a wood. Push it probably there.
I'll park next to your car. Watch out.
She knows my car. I'm in trouble. Don't move into it. Sarah, thank you very much for coming here. Well done, mate. It's your brilliant contribution. I know it's difficult to be in these sorts of situations in your early days. Now, as you know, next up on We Are Recovery Radio is, let's call him an agony uncle, because agony is something he certainly provides. It's Mark Dempster. Come in here and talk to me. Mark, how are you feeling about doing what, let's face it, will be your first ever live show on Recovery Radio, where you'll be taking calls from people suffering from addiction issues? Are you feeling confident about that, or do you think you might simply make matters worse?
Ross, I knew you would say something like this. No, I think I could be of help because I'm in a really fortunate position to hear from the public and then obviously to offer some of my experience too. And also, of course, I'm in recovery for just over 20 years now, so no, apart from being a Mary wins, doesn't she?
Yeah,
she's the top dog.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Well done.
But no, I think it's a great opportunity to give as much
Why are you the agony uncle? What qualifications can
Okay, Russell, I'll explain it as quickly as possible. Not that I'm aware of, but I'm in recovery myself, personal recovery of addiction for 20 years.
So
years.
For 20 years. And also, but I've been to college and I'm a therapist in Harley Street and I've got a number of different qualifications in traumatology and counselling and hypnotherapy. So I've done a lot of studying throughout the years too. And so I work with people just in addictions all the time.
I see. You've made recovery your job. And obviously, yeah. I know this and I'm being sarcastic and ridiculous, but you're a Harley Street therapist now and dealing with addiction-based or absence-based recovery is your bread and butter.
Yeah, because I've just, it's completely focused on addiction. But of course, my life's changed massively from the person that I was years ago, and I've wrote a couple of books, and I'm, you know, I was, I used to use a lot of drugs and was involved in a lot of smuggling at one time, and I live a very clean, straight life. And
honestly, and do you? How clean? How straight?
I am really clean. I've no criminal behaviour. No, I mean, I don't even.
Have you been to prison a lot? I mean, I know sometimes that's a redundant question with a Scottish person.
Absolutely. Not in Spain. I was in jail in 1986 in Spain because we used to bring carloads of hash out of Spain and from Morocco and. So I've done a little bit of time there and in Belmarsh Prison here in London just before. In fact, Belmarsh Prison is where it all began, really. I got sentenced.
Oh, those wistful days at Belmarsh
Prison. And that was the beginning of it. And then I went off to Bournemouth, where Sarah's from, for residential treatment. And when I was in residential treatment, my therapist was somebody that I knew from many years before. He was part of a sort of gangster family in Glasgow. He used to do armed robberies. And he was a therapist, and I thought, my God, if he can transform his life and from gangsterhood to becoming a therapist, I mean, I could maybe do the same thing.
Sometimes I like to imagine, Mark, when you're talking, that I'm interviewing you for a job at a bank.
Well, Mr. Dixon, thank you very much for applying. Oh, then I was in prison in Spain. Well, thank you. Nurse!
A bit like Spud from Trainspotting, yeah.
No, well, listen, in all seriousness, Mark, you're a person who I know very well, and I think that people can benefit a great deal from you, both as a therapist and from another voice in recovery, the therapeutic value of one addict speaking to another. Coming up next, with your opportunity to speak to Mark Dempster. We are Recovery Radio. You've been listening to the Russell Brand Show. Thank you very much, all of you, for your contributions.
Thank you, Russell.
Thank you, Russell.
Mark, coming up next.